and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's unique lack of qualification for the presidency based on the country's history, where not one U.S. president has assumed the office with no prior government or military experience. Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joins us to discuss how the military and intelligence bureaucracy will find a way to deal with a new chief executive of the government, who is also commander-in-chief, and whether there are any checks and balances on the president in the executive branch if Trump surrounds himself with a coterie of sycophants and enablers like Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, and Newt Gingrich, and puts General Flynn in a key national security position in spite of Flynn's murky ties to the Kremlin. Then we'll assess how the election of Trump is seen overseas by going to the UK and speaking with one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. Toby Miller, a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, joins us to discuss how world leaders have reacted to Trump's win and the president-elect's ties to Putin and the European far right, in particular the architect of the Brexit vote, Nigel Farage, who has campaigned with Trump and is elated by his election win that Farage has declared is Brexit times three. Then finally, with Russia escalating its bombing of Syria's largest city, Aleppo, in conjunction with a ground assault by the Assad regime's army and Iranian and Russian troops, we will discuss the lack of concern for human rights among some of the European and American left, who used to be opposed to dictators the U.S. supported in Latin America during the Cold War, but nowadays make apologies for dictators like Putin, Gaddafi, and Assad, who not only have contempt for human rights, but are capitalist kleptocrats. Evan Sandlin, a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Davis, joins us to discuss his article in the Los Angeles Review of Books, Dereliction of Duty, The Left and the Syrian Civil War. And joining us now is Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, who is a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance in post-conflict countries, fragile states, and states in transition. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and was named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine. Secretary Clinton appointed Rachel to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the U.S. Department of State, and she worked in human rights and economic development in India, Israel, and Eastern Europe, and has served as an elections monitor in Pakistan and Bangladesh, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Lovely to be here, Ian.
And what kind of a challenge do you think Donald Trump is going to have? He's meeting with the president today in terms of getting the transition going, and the president's made it clear that he wants a smooth transition and was very grateful to the transition help that he got from George W. Bush in Obama's transition. But clearly you'd need to start filling national security slots already. There's some speculation, I've read articles that saying Trump versus the national security establishment, will there be a revolution in U.S. foreign policy? And you've already had the former CIA director and NSA director, Michael Hayden, just last week accusing Trump of being a tool of the Russian government. So going in, what kind of atmosphere is there in the national security and the intelligence community vis-a-vis the new president of the United States?
You know, we had a meeting of the senior fellows at the Carnegie Endowment this morning, which is all of our global offices as well as all of our Washington leading researchers, and the mood was glum, to say the least. I would say Republicans and Democrats almost universally are concerned about this man having his finger on the nuclear button, about him having access to classified material. He has shown that he doesn't pay a lot of attention to classified material, and I think that leads to concerns that he'll misuse it, if not just ignore it. And he really does not seem to share most of the national security world's beliefs about who our enemies and who our allies are. He is very pro-Putin, very pro-Russia. He has business interests in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and in China, despite the fact that he's claimed to want to fight China on trade. His business interests push the other direction. So I would say there's a handful of national security leaders who have not condemned him. But on the Republican side, the vast majority of those who have served have already come out against him. And that means he'll have a very few people to pick from his cabinet, unless he picks people who have already said they're against him, which would be awkward, to say the least.
Well, as far as I can tell, this is, I think, it's certainly in the modern era, the first presidential candidate and now president-elect who has not revealed his tax returns. And we know that he's had business dealings in Russia, and there's all kinds of speculation about that. But isn't it important to know whether the leader of the United States is vulnerable to any overseas influence, whether he has creditors or even if where there's some blackmail? It's been very hard to understand what is the basis of this peculiar affection that he has for Vladimir Putin. My sense is that Putin is actually obsessed with the United States, and his main goal is to make America weak, and I think he's found the right person to help him.
I would agree with you there, actually. I think the main people who are rejoicing, if you look at Twitter feeds from around the world, are authoritarian leaders who I think see in Trump one of their own, but also someone who will break our traditional alliances and therefore isolate America and make us weaker. And also radicals, radical Islamists and so on, are celebrating, I think, because they believe that Trump will further radicalize populations and allow them to gain recruits. So that's not a pretty picture around the world. But I want to get back to your point on conflicts of interest, because I'm stunned that Hillary Clinton didn't bring this up more during the election. But we have a significant, sort of stunningly large problem here. Presidents and vice presidents are not required to get rid of their business assets during their terms. Unlike appointed officials, they don't have to put them in a blind trust. They have disclosure requirements, but those disclosure requirements just mean they have to tell the world what they own. It doesn't mean that they have to do anything with it. So we could have a case of a sitting president who either directly continues to control businesses in many parts of the world that we have disagreements with, where he'll have a real conflict of interest. He may choose to pass those businesses on to his children, in which case he could have a daughter or a son turn up in a sensitive country like Russia, Uzbekistan, China, just at a moment when we're trying to do a diplomatic activity there or a military activity there. It's unprecedented. He's got over 500 businesses. So we have no idea how many conflicts he has, but he doesn't need to get rid of them once he's president.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was formerly the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and was named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine. And Secretary Clinton appointed Rachel to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory board to the U.S. Department of State. And she's the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Well, one of the stories that the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal have been sitting on for some time now is, and it's come out a little bit in Slate, is the story about a possible back channel between the Kremlin, Putin, and Trump with a server in Trump Tower that's supposedly connected to the Alpha Bank. And these leaks appear to be coming from British intelligence. My understanding is that a lot of the European leaders and the NATO leaders, et cetera, are extremely concerned about Trump. And is it possible? I mean, first of all, we know that Rudolph Giuliani has been put in, Trump has put him in charge of prosecuting their enemies. And you know that Giuliani has this obsessive grudge against Hillary Clinton and literally wants to lock her up. He has said as much, that he wants to put her in jail. Could we have a strange situation here where you recall that Richard Nixon won the presidency handily, and then shortly thereafter, the Watergate worm began to turn. Is it possible that we could have some kind of inquiry into Trump's connections to the Kremlin?
It's certainly possible. It's more difficult with a Republican-controlled Senate and House. Usually that sort of thing happens as with the Clinton administration under Bill Clinton. It happens when you've got a Congress that wants to go after a president. So so I'm not sure whether there's actual grounds for such an investigation. There may be. The intelligence community is quite concerned about how Trump has acted with regards to the WikiLeaks and other intelligence that they believe has come from the Russians. However, there's also ongoing activity with Trump that we know about. He's got a civil lawsuit pending over Trump University. He's got a lawsuit pending over allegations of child rape. These are happening without any political activity. So it's going to be an interesting run for this president. I don't think any American, no matter how much we dislike Trump, wants to see our democracy further degraded. I think it's quite important that we not allow that to happen. But that doesn't mean that we can't hold Trump accountable for breaking democratic laws and norms.
Well, one of the things about the sort of highest level of national security, and that is the National Security Council, that are close to the president, and I mentioned Richard Nixon. I happen to be friends with Alex Butterfield, who was very close and, of course, ended up being the person who provided the evidence that there was a taping system which led to the downfall of President Nixon. And then I also know John Dean well, and one of the things that they always tell me how what a really extremely competent president Nixon was, particularly on national security affairs. But occasionally he got a little tipsy. And the purpose of the national security advisor, in this case Henry Kissinger, in many ways, the question is, who is there as a check and balance on the president inside the executive branch itself? And in the case of Nixon, you know, one of the jobs that Kissinger had as national security advisor was literally to protect the president from himself. And I believe you can make the case in many ways that somebody like Condoleezza Rice did not protect George Bush from himself, because she didn't essentially stand up to him. So that's my understanding of the role, or at least a part of the role, of a national security advisor. Do you see anybody, because Trump's surrounded by these sycophants like Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, and Newt Gingrich. And if General Flynn's his idea of a national security advisor, then God help us.
Yes. Well, much of the Republican national security establishment has condemned Trump. A few have not, and they would be the most likely choices. Steve Hadley, who was George W. Bush's national security advisor, did not come out against Trump. And I know Steve. I believe that he's a quite honorable and decent man. And although we disagree about certain things, my guess is that he chose not to come out because he saw the writing on the wall and thought he could be a check or a balance if the time came. And I think he would be a decent one. Jim Woolsey came out, former CIA director, former national intelligence director when that covered the CIA and other forms of intelligence. He came out and endorsed Trump. I was not happy to see that at the time. I've known Jim for many years, but now perhaps he could serve as a check. He's got a storied history and can be a bit of a maverick on these thoughts. So he might fit well with Trump's personality while still having a good head on his shoulders. So there are a few, but there aren't many.
But do you accept that premise that sort of necessary, that you need kind of an adult in the room, even to sort of check the unlimited power that the president has in that regard?
So presidential power, I think, is a very funny thing. On the one hand, presidents have a large amount of power to do things with the stroke of a pen. Trump can immediately start his anti-immigration policies, for instance. On the other hand, there are layers of bureaucracy, civil servants, foreign service officers, and so on, and it can be very difficult for presidents to enact goals that they wanted to enact. You know, when President Bill Clinton was running for office, he said he was going to move the embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and he was never able to do that, largely because of bureaucratic pushback. So it's a funny thing, presidential power. Trump will have more of it because he has a united Senate and House, all on the Republican side. So unless the Republican Party chooses to act as the balance that the legislative branch should act as against any president, he's going to have a much easier time of it than most. But even so, he won't have unprecedented power. To get to your question, I think personality matters a vast amount in the U.S. system. We really believe that we have a system of institutions, but we have a system of people. And if a president doesn't want a check on his power, he won't appoint a national security advisor who will serve as one.
Well, we all know that there's this aide, military aide, with the briefcase, the football chained to his wrist, that follows the president around. And that leads to this incredibly dangerous situation we have, where in effect we have kind of psychological disarmament between the U.S. and the Russians, but we don't have the physical disarmament. And tensions have risen lately, and there's even been talk on the Russian side of the utility of nuclear weapons, which is a scary thought. And the worst part of that system is that if there is an alert, and the Russians have what they call a chiget, and there was an alert when Yeltsin, thank God he was sober, it was in the morning, that the Norwegian research rocket went up and they thought it was a Trident missile. And you know, Yeltsin was given the choice to launch the arsenal. So these things do happen. And the whole idea that what's so scary about this system is that the president only has about 4 or 5 minutes to make the most earth-shattering decision that's really where the fate of the planet hangs in the balance. So that's what we think about in terms of the button. Of course, that's what Hillary Clinton had kept trying to allude to in the last weeks or so, which I understand there was some dissent within her campaign over whether she should turn to the economic issues at the end there rather than talk about how bad Trump was. And there's no point in doing any autopsy on that, I guess. But in general, that's where the rubber meets the road, isn't it?
Well, you know, here's one little bright spot of optimism, I would say, that we're probably further from violence with Russia than we were before Trump's victory. I think that Trump will heal relations with Russia. I think he'll heal them by making America deferential to Russian foreign policy preferences, which is not how most of us might want that that rift to go. But I do think that we'll end up in a much more positive, easy relationship with Russia. It'll just be positive and easy and less conflictual, because Russia will be getting their way around the world. And in fact, we might be helping them. You know, one of the things Trump has promised to do is fight on Russia's side against ISIS, but in effect putting Syria's President Bashar Assad in complete power over his country. And while the media tends to recount all the horrors of ISIS because they make great media stories and because they are horrific, Assad has killed far, far more of his own people than ISIS has, killed far more women, far more children, far more unarmed civilians. So, you know, now the U.S. will probably be on the side of that man. We're on the side of other dictators around the world, and we have long been. Saudi Arabia comes to mind. So it's not unprecedented, but I think for people fighting for their rights or freedoms around the world, they won't be able to look to the U.S. anymore, and that's a pretty large departure from anything that's gone on in our history throughout the 20th century and the 21st.
Well, we've already known, though, that since Putin intervened in Syria, very shortly thereafter, there was a massive exodus that ended up swamping Europe and creating all kinds of social problems in Europe. If they go ahead with the offensive which is underway against Aleppo, and they do take Aleppo, and they do put Assad back in power, there's going to be a massive exodus of the Sunni, which is the majority, 80% majority. And what we saw in Europe a couple of years back is going to pale in comparison to that. So I don't see how you can, you know, just by rolling over for Putin, accept that kind of behavior and what has been described as the weaponization of refugees.
You know, we'll have to see if Trump cares. He's already said that he wants to make our allies pay for more of their own defense. That would probably entail more of them getting nuclear weapons. Those are cheap ways to pay for one's own defense in lieu of a big army. So you'll see more proliferation around the world. It's not clear that Trump really cares about European defense or about the EU. He doesn't seem to care much about multilateral organizations. So if swamping Europe with refugees causes the rise of more far-right politicians in Europe and breaking apart of the European Union and more dissension on that continent, it's not clear to me that Trump would bother himself over that. Now, the world might. You know, the biggest world wars, the most deadly wars in modern history have been fought in Europe, and the EU was what kept that from happening for the last half century. So we might regret losing it once we've lost it, but I'm not sure Trump will.
Well, just in closing, you brought up immigration and how with the stroke of the pen, Donald Trump can cause enormous pain to the children that are being held here in the United States or protected here in the United States, the unaccompanied minors that Obama has protected under DACA, which Trump will erase with the stroke of a pen, and these kids will be sent back to El Salvador where there's no rule of law and these gangs run rampant. That's just a small window into the kind of blithe cruelty that we may experience with somebody who doesn't seem to have much compassion for anything but himself and his family. However, you did when we last spoke, you said when you go around the country talking about national security, people come up to you and talk about immigration. It is something that really bothers people in this country, and it's clearly been something that Trump has been able to use as a rallying cry and perhaps even abuse as a hot-button issue. So why, just in closing in the last minute, why have the Democrats not recognized this as the overriding issue that it is?
You know, I can't speak to why Democrats haven't done more on immigration. Obama promised to try, and frankly, his record was not that great. I think people will look back and think it was much better than Trump's. But, 30% of Latinos voted for Trump. So clearly something is going on that is not well understood by the elites of the country, and I can't claim to understand it myself. I would say that the last time I can think of that a president like Trump was elected was in 1828 when President Jackson was elected. He was a populist. The vote had just been expanded to more poor white men, and they voted for him en masse, and the elites were livid and concerned. And they had a great right to be. The masses elected Andrew Jackson in part because they thought he would fight corruption. That was one of his campaign planks. He did fight certain forms of corruption, but he also brought in the spoils system, which grew into the biggest force for political machines and corruption that America had ever had, much, much worse than what had gone before. He was equally blithe about human rights and, of course, was responsible for the roundup and removal of Indians on the Trail of Tears. And if that's what we're in for now, I think we'll need to think really hard about what we do 4 years from now and what we do between now and 4 years to put our country in a better spot. And rather than pointing fingers at the Democrats right now, I'd love to think about how do we move forward? How do we connect with what clearly is an electorate that is pretty angry with the status quo and with the elites not listening to them, that really did form a silent majority that was not heard? And what do we do to get them back, get them convinced that democracy works, and get them to move toward a candidate who could actually make America great again 4 years from now.
Well, Dr. Rachel Klanfeld, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Klanfeld, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and was named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine. And Secretary Clinton appointed Rachel to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the U.S. Department of State. And she's the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing how the election of Trump is seen overseas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Toby Miller, a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Good to be back with you, Ian.
And Toby, I'm calling you. You're in the UK, and Nigel Farage, the head of UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, who was, I think, largely or the mostly responsible for the Brexit vote, is absolutely crowing and saying that Donald Trump's election win is Brexit times three. So in the UK, what is the, I mean, if you can give us a sort of general response to this phenomenon, which, of course, has a lot of people in America scratching their heads. So I imagine in the rest of the world, there's a lot of dismay as well.
Yes, I think that here we find people like Farage, who, by the way, isn't an elected politician in Britain. He is, ironically, a member of the European Parliament, and that's his only democratically elected status, even though, as you say, he led the move to leave the European Union and hence end British participation in that parliament. People like him are, of course, no doubt delighted, and we've seen a certain welcoming of Mr. Trump's success, at least in formal terms, by the Conservative Party, which is the governing party in the UK. We've had a very interesting response from Jeremy Corbyn, who is, in a sense, the Bernie Sanders of Britain, leading the Labour Party here. Bernie's brother is actually a member of that party and lives here and is a candidate for an election that's upcoming. A very interesting response from Corbyn, who basically has interpreted the election result as a rejection of the failure of neoliberalism and financial globalization, but an unfortunate expression of rage in response to that that has taken the form of a bigoted and prejudicial nationalistic loathing of the other. So he's made quite an interesting interpretation, I think. Nicola Sturgeon, who is the leader of the Scottish Nationalist Party, which, unlike UKIP, has many members of Parliament here in the UK, has described this as a very unfortunate result and not what she had wanted. The Scots, of course, from whom Mr. Trump proudly announces his own descent, have very bitter experiences of him as a landlord developer in terms of his golf courses, jobs that were promised and were not given, environmental rules that were broken, and the litany of abuse of capitalist systems that is the hallmark of his corporate life.
So is there any sense, though, because there's been a lot of leaks from British intelligence to the press, to the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal and others, about the connections between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin and a back channel through the Alpha Bank, which is in to a server in Trump Tower. The Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal have been sitting on this story. And obviously, the reason that it's being leaked is that a lot of foreign leaders are very concerned that Donald Trump may well be being blackmailed by the Russians, or because he has not revealed his tax returns or anything about his financial dealings, we don't know who he owes money to, who has leverage over him, who might be blackmailing him. These are really fundamental concerns which have not arisen. And the fact that you have there in the UK, Julian Assange, who's done everything he can to tip the scales in Trump's favor, and he's been very successful because we have not read Trump's emails. None of them have been available, but all of Hillary Clinton's have, thanks to Russian intelligence and to their conduit, WikiLeaks. So what's the sense in the UK about what's going to happen vis-a-vis a Trump presidency in terms of NATO, etc.?
Well, I think you've touched on some very important issues. The way in which most of these politicians, not Corbyn, because Corbyn is also quite pro-Russia and hence rather dubious about Syria, but the way in which these other politicians have spoken is, on the one hand, to say Atlanticism reigns forever, i.e. the so-called special relationship between Washington, D.C. and London. But on the other, they're saying they're very concerned about the future of NATO, and we've heard that from the French, the Germans, the NATO bureaucracy, and people right at the top of the European Union. They are extremely concerned. They see, quite rightly, the recrudescence of Russian imperialism, its reinvigoration under President Putin, and a sense that the U.S. commitment to NATO is compromised. After all, one of the things that Trump said in his campaign was, and this is a recurring theme in some aspects of the Republican Party in particular, that NATO should pay its own way. Why should the U.S. do all of these things for the Europeans? On the other hand, of course, people recognize that there is clearly something real about the questions being raised with regard to his business dealings with Russia, his dependency on what appear to be the dirty tricks department of the Kremlin, and so on. I mean, one of the incredible sleights of hand that Trump is seen over here as having achieved is, on the one hand, to be an isolationist Republican, which is a long-standing tendency that predates the so-called liberal internationalism of the Bushes, and on the other, to be in bed with a traditional American enemy in Russia. I mean, if a Democratic nominee spoke about Mr. Putin the way that Mr. Trump has, they would basically be subject to cries of jail him or jail her that we've become so used to during this rancid campaign that he's run. So, yes, I think the apparatchiks, the bureaucrats, the politicians involved in NATO are extremely concerned. And, of course, all of us who are horrified by the authoritarian populism of Putin are concerned. On the other hand, of course, you're getting politicians on the right, the far right in France and Italy, like Marine Le Pen, who are celebrating because, like Nigel Farage here, they see this as a return to a virulent form of nationalism that suits their politics. And this is, of course, the worry that a lot of people on the center-right, the center-left, the middle ground in general of politics see, a tendency in which parliamentary democracy is utilized by extremists pushing a populist nationalism that is a short road, a quick path to a really authoritarian form of government.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who is in the United Kingdom. He's a professor of media and culture studies at Cardiff University and one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. And, of course, Putin's motive in supporting Trump and Le Pen and others are, first of all, they're like-minded neo-proto-fascists, as is Putin himself in a Russian form of fascism, certainly not Nazism, which is something you shouldn't ever ascribe to Russians, considering what they endured during what they call the Great Patriotic War. But it would seem to me quite simply that what Putin is really about is weakening America, and Trump will weaken America. So what's your sense of the role of your fellow Australian there in the Ecuadorian embassy, Julian Assange? He seems to be the epitome of the sort of knee-jerk anti-American left, along with John Pilger and others, who just simply hate America and turn a blind eye to Russia and China and other countries. They've never really gone after them, ever. So what is going on there in terms of, do they really want a fascist, a neo-fascist in the United States? Is that their sort of dream, or is there some personal motive here that Trump will pardon him because Trump's already praised WikiLeaks and maybe there's a deal there?
I have never been a fan, I have to say, of Julian Assange. And I should say, when you call him my fellow Australian, I'm also a U.S. citizen and
so
a British citizen. I'm a free rider who gets disappointed electorally in every place that he calls home. As far as I'm concerned, Assange is naive, arrogant, charismatic, but above all, pretty stupid. And what he's done is certainly part of an anti-American vitriol that he feels. But it's also anti-statist, it is anti-authoritarian, it is anti-bourgeois media, it is cybertarian in the sense of a kind of libertarianism driven by the internet. It is also driven, no doubt, by his fear of the sexual violence charges that are placed against him. It's driven, no doubt, by his fear of the United States and British secret security services. Those fears are understandable. Many of us would like to see him face the charges laid against him in Sweden and have to return there. He is being protected, of course, by the Ecuadorian government, though they got very concerned in the latter days of the campaign about his role. Perhaps he does seek a pardon from President-elect Trump. I think that would be hard for Trump to pull off, given the animus towards Assange that has been expressed by Fox News, by the security establishment in the U.S., by many of Trump's supporters.
They
are perhaps aware of just how central WikiLeaks has been in his triumph.
Right, but Toby, Fox only went after Assange when they also went after Snowden, but lately they've been praising him, Hannity and O'Reilly. They think he's wonderful because he's been revealing all of these emails, you know, literally reading Hillary Clinton's mail. And by the way, if it was Russian intelligence that targeted John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, the logical reason was to give that stuff to Trump. I mean, WikiLeaks just got sloppy seconds.
Point taken, and I have no doubt that the kinds of automatic position taking that Fox News specializes in did precisely that. But I think they flip-flop all the time, and they will flip-flop now that, in a sense, WikiLeaks has outlived its purpose. Just as Mr. Trump appears to have veered between saying that his first task in office will be to arrest Hillary Clinton and have her clapped in irons. And then in his acceptance speech, he thanked her for her many years of public service and that of her family. So my guess is that Fox News will simply move right along and back towards its notion of Assange as betraying the interests of the United States, because that will be strategically more in its interest.
Well, the one thing that perhaps we're going to be spared is Trump TV, run by Breitbart's Bannon and Roger Ailes. But nevertheless, it does seem that I would not discount the possibility of a jihad against Hillary Clinton, particularly with the Congress. The real investigation should be rather what happened with Watergate. Richard Nixon had a sweeping victory, and then slowly thereafter, the Watergate worm began to turn and led to his downfall. In this case, if there were inquiries into Trump's connections to the Russians and how much they helped elect him, that may well end up being much, much worse than Watergate. But what, in fact, we're going to have...
I quite agree, and I think what we have to wait for is what I presume will happen, and here is my good news story, that in the midterms in 2018, Trump will have sent the economy south as a consequence of what I imagine will be a series of crazed tax cuts at the same time as there is a series of crazed increased forms of expenditure on the military, and that will see a Democratic majority potentially in both houses, and that along with the revelations to come of the kind you've mentioned and also about his tax affairs will lead to his impeachment and potential conviction.
Well, I was going to say, in the meantime, even though he's put out an olive branch to Hillary Clinton, and today he's visiting the White House, he's also put Rudy Giuliani in charge of prosecutions and retribution. And Giuliani, of course, is obsessed with putting Hillary Clinton in jail. He's said that on any number of occasions. So I don't know. Just in general, what's your sense there from the UK? Are people willing to, as Obama is and Hillary Clinton is, to sort of, you know, go along with the idea of the continuity of government and praising the democratic process without mentioning this extraordinary anti-democratic turn of events here in the United States? Not that he wasn't fairly elected, although it's worth remembering that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and we've got this crazy electoral college that enabled Trump's victory and George W. Bush's victory in 2000 as well. So that's an anomaly. But in general, Trump did animate rather anti-democratic forces, which are also lurking there in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the rhetoric that he used about the possibility of people taking arms should he not win the election, is precisely the rhetoric adopted by Nigel Farage with reference to a recent High Court decision here. The High Court is the one below the Supreme Court in Britain, that said that Parliament, i.e. Congress here, must participate in any governmental negotiations and invocation of Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which is the one that would facilitate Britain's departure from the European Union. Farage said, you know, there may be violence in the streets and so on. So these people are certainly not above that sort of talk. So far, what we've seen from the major lawmakers, elected officials here and in Europe, is on the one hand a concern, rather sotto voce, about Trump as a person, as a businessman, and as somebody who is, in a sense, interpolating the far right with his notion of violence against any process that goes against his interests. And on the other, a formal welcoming of the successful iteration of U.S. democracy and a recognition that within the constitutional terms that exist, he did indeed win. Now, what capacity they will have to influence how he operates, I don't know. It's one of these moments when people like me, who are no friends of technocrats, hope that the technocrats within the Republican Party, the people who know how to deal with the crazies and make the trains run more or less on time, manage to make their peace with Trump and enter into his private deliberations, as opposed to fellow maniacs like Giuliani and others who have been mooted as cabinet appointees.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you very much for joining us from the UK.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the lack of concern for human rights among some in the European and American left. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Evan Sandlin, who's a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Davis, where he's studying the effect of U.S. values on foreign aid through social and psychological mechanisms. He has an article at the Los Angeles Review of Books, Dereliction of Duty, The Left and the Syrian Civil War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Evan Sandlin.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And of course, there's a major offensive underway with the Russians, the Iranians, and the Assad regime's army, and what's left of it, pounding Aleppo. And we've seen the agony that's going on inside of Aleppo, and the consequences, of course, of a likely victory by Russia, Iran, and the Assad regime will be a massive outflow of Sunni refugees, which perhaps will make what happened in Europe with a million people suddenly showing up on the shores of Greece look like a rehearsal. But nevertheless, what's your understanding then of why on the left in this country and in Europe, etc., why has the left changed from back in the 80s? Of course, they were the champions of human rights against the murderous dictatorship in El Salvador, against the Contras, etc. They were always, you know, the people with principle. But now they seem to have, at least a lot of the left seems to have a fascination for dictators whose sons drive around and crash Ferraris for sport. I just find it extraordinary how you hear these apologists, maybe not on the traditional left, but on the far left, for all of these dictators like Gaddafi and Assad. So what happened to the moral compass of the political left?
I mean, I think even in the 1980s through today, the left's always kind of had an enemy of my enemy is my friend sort of problem. In my article, I explain how a sizable portion of the left even supported the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the 80s. And I think there's multiple things going on. There's the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and then there's kind of this reluctance to admit how bad the Assad regime is, in part because it's been a regime that's opposed U.S. interests in the region. There's this perception that the Assad regime is a secular and socialist state. I mean, if one looks at the facts, this is plainly just not the case. The Assad regime, especially recently in the mid-2000s, cooperated with the Bush administration in the war on terror, went through a period of neoliberalization. It's by no means a kind of socialist state that has always opposed U.S. interests, but they still are looking at it through this Cold War lens. And then I think there's a real fear of further U.S. intervention, which isn't, I had expected to talk about intervention in the case of a Clinton presidency, but that's really no less of a concern, I think, with a Trump presidency. He's pledged to increase the bombing campaign. And there's this reluctance on the left to admit Assad's crimes in the fear that this will somehow empower domestic forces that are pushing for U.S. intervention in Syria. And I just think that's a mistake. I think it's a logical, completely logical and coherent position to oppose the suffering imposed by the Assad regime, and also say that, you know, U.S. military intervention might have the effect of increasing that suffering, and therefore we should be opposed to that too.
And again, I'm speaking with Evan Sandlin, a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Davis, where he's studying the effect of U.S. values on foreign aid through social and psychological mechanisms. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Review of Books, Dereliction of Duty, The Left and the Syrian Civil War. So what's your sense then of... we're talking about sort of ideological inconsistency, if not ideological confusion. And now the fears that we'd have an interventionist, neoconservative foreign policy under a President Hillary Clinton have given way to kind of, I don't know, a mystifying anticipation of what Donald Trump's foreign policy is going to be. It's certainly got the it's got the Europeans worried whether he's going to even abandon NATO. So what's your sense of what's going to happen, particularly now in the theater that we're talking about, Syria, where there's just been just the Russians and the Iranians and the Assad regime have been absolutely barbaric in killing Syrian people. And, of course, on the other side, you've got these hideous jihadis. So there's no good guys as far as we can tell. But if there are any good guys, they're the victims, and it looks like we're going to sell them out. Is that in the cards, do you think?
It's very hard to tell with the Trump presidency. I think on one hand, we have to remember that there are two interventions going on in Syria right now. One is the U.S. bombing campaign against ISIS and other rebel groups that abuses terrorist groups that it doesn't like. On the other hand, there's the U.S. intervention along with the Gulf allies, which is funding many rebel groups against the Assad regime. And from what Trump has said, it seems like he wants to escalate the first kind of intervention. He wants a larger bombing campaign against ISIS and other groups. And really, at least from what he says, seems like he's not such a huge fan of intervention in supporting rebel groups against the Assad regime. However, we have to remember that it's not individuals that make policy, although you know, the president has influence. He's going to be surrounded by a State Department that the Washington Post reported a few weeks ago was very much wanting to have a greater U.S. military role in Syria. He's going to be surrounded by Pentagon officials. He's going to be surrounded by his vice president, who was kind of breaking with him in the debate, saying that he would support intervention against the Assad regime in Syria. So apart from an increased U.S. bombing campaign and escalation in a U.S. bombing campaign against ISIS and al-Qaeda in Syria, I really think it's difficult to tell what Trump is going to do with regards to Assad. It's just a lot of different actors involved, and we'll see what type of position the administration ends up taking.
Well, but on the surface, he wants to make a deal with Putin, or at least he says, you know, why don't we get along? Sort of using the Rodney King refrain. So what would you expect then in a sort of global deal with the Russians? Wouldn't it be great if we were friends? Well, the way to become, first of all, we don't know what the arrangement is and the relationship between Putin and Trump, because we simply haven't been able to get the information. We haven't got Trump's tax returns. We don't know which Russian oligarchs he's borrowed money from or anything about his business dealings and what ties he might have. But that aside, what would wouldn't a global deal with Putin involve essentially, you know, backing away from Ukraine and Syria?
It's difficult to tell. I mean, we have been cooperating with Putin, in Syria, at least. The position of the United States has been, you know, we'll focus on bombing our, the rebel groups we don't like. You can, bomb other rebel groups that you don't like. And although the U.S., you know, will voice concern at Assad and Russia's crimes, it really has coordinated with them in Syria. As far as further cooperation with Russia under a Trump presidency, it could take two forms, one of which I think would be possibly helpful, and that would be a coordinated withdrawal from Syria by both parties in an attempt to de-escalate the conflict. The other possible type of cooperation you could have is a Trump administration putting its full weight behind Assad and Russia in Syria and essentially helping Assad retake the entire country. I don't know which one of those is more likely, or we could have the status quo if officials in the Pentagon and the State Department have their way. But I think the most helpful type of cooperation that could happen with Putin would be for both parties to withdraw from the Syrian conflict.
Well, what we do know is that, the victims of this war, the Syrian people, one-third of whom are displaced, if not a half now, about 500,000 have been killed, and they're in these crowded refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. And there's no question that Donald Trump has closed the door on Muslims in general, and Syrians in particular. He made a political campaign issue out of not letting Syrians in, and the United States has let in only one-third of the number that the Canadians next door have let in. So what do you expect to happen on that front?
Oh, I expect a very regressive policy on refugees from a Trump administration for the reasons you stated. I mean, he's just openly expressed kind of hostility towards refugees, but also because the Democrats, even in Congress, have been pretty spineless when it has come to this issue. In fact, representative we just voted in, or re-voted in Davis, Garamendi, voted to basically not allow any more refugees until we increase vetting. But anyone who knows the UN vetting process knows it's a pretty intense process, and would be much easier for terrorists, for example, to get a normal visa to the United States. But I expect a very regressive policy, and if the escalation in Syria continues, of course, that will exacerbate the refugee problem, the burden of which will fall on Lebanon and Jordan, and, you know, could fall on Europe as well. So really, if it would be the worst of both worlds if Trump's refugee policy was as regressive as he wants it to be, and if you had escalation in Syria, whether that be full support of the Assad regime or whether that be an increased bombing campaign in Syria.
Well, at the risk of going off on a tangent, Evan Sandlin, when you mentioned Garamendi being re-elected up there where you are in Davis, California, this is one of the ironies about this Trump campaign and his victory. And the people that followed him were really captivated by this idea of draining the swamp of, you know, change and radical change and just getting rid of all of these establishment politicians and just cleaning house in Washington. And yet, you know, he may have cleaned house in terms of Hillary Clinton, but almost the entire incumbents in both the House and the Senate were reelected. So how can you be draining the swamp when you got the same people back in Washington?
Yeah, it's a paradox of American politics. Congress has an extremely low approval rating, worst in history, but local representatives remain very popular. So essentially everyone hates Congress, but everyone likes their own representative. It'll be interesting to see if you do have any large policy changes. Again, we have to remember that individuals do not decide policy, and whatever policies Trump ends up taking are going to be a function of his cabinet, which could remain very interventionist, very pro-status quo on Syria. But I do expect a regressive refugee policy, because the same people in Congress who have been against Obama's refugee policy are still there, and now they have an advocate for their regressive views in the White House, too.
Right, but if he puts in General Flynn, this whack job from the DIA, who is his favorite general, he's Putin's guy, for God's sake. I mean, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And, you know, who knows? General Flynn might be Secretary of Defense or National Security Advisor.
Yeah, I've been reading through possible cabinet selections today. And, it's pretty scary to imagine how the cabinet could turn out. But, you know, there are a lot of bureaucrats and, a lot of ways that they could perhaps temper some of the more extreme views of a Trump cabinet. But regardless, I'm not optimistic about the next few years here.
Well, Evan Sandlin, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Evan Sandlin, who's a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Davis, where he's studying the effect of U.S. values on foreign aid through social and psychological mechanisms. He has an article at the Los Angeles Review of Books, Dereliction of Duty, The Left and the Syrian Civil War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.